Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Zachary Quinto returns to Broadway in The Boys in the Band. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to the show. Welcome to my podcast. Welcome back, Sammy, to
welcome,
the intro.
Welcome, Josh.
You don't have to
welcome,
welcome
to your
me.
Own show.
Thank you.
No one ever welcomes you.
Thank you for having me on my show.
Thank you for being here. It's an honor.
Oh, that's really weird. anyway, Zachary Quinto is on the show. Yay!
Yay! We're Zach.
Zach. You can call him Zach.
Yeah.
We're buds. Yes, Zachary Quinto, first time guest on the podcast. Long time coming. Zachary's great. What a career. What an amazing run on Broadway he's experiencing right now. He's in Boys in the Band.
And he is.
You saw this too,
yes,
right? You saw the show.
My favorite. He's so good in this show.
She's not lying. I do remember now when I asked, Sammy saw it ahead of me, and I asked her what she thought. The one thing, I mean, she liked a lot of
but
you said Zachary steals the show.
The second he steps on stage, the whole show, you can't take your eyes off of him. He's just... I think he's so, because he's so quiet in it too.
But great one-liners.
Oh, yes. And just like the way he holds himself. Everyone goes see him and it is great.
He makes a big entrance. So yeah, a little context about this show. Boys in the Band is a 50-year-old show. 50 years ago, it was on Broadway. It was a real important play for its time in that it's a story of, I think, 9 characters celebrating a character's birthday. It's a birthday party that kind of goes off the rails. And it's 9 gay men. Mm-hmm. The current cast is all...
Well...
Right, that's true. Okay, well, yeah, okay. Well, we're close enough.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't want to reel too much.
No spoilers.
Exactly. No Boys in the
it's
Band
like Avengers.
Spoilers. Exactly. Yeah. Thanos is at the end.
Snap of the fingers, yeah.
But notable about this cast, they haven't changed much of the show, apparently. I think they've cut a little bit. It's a one act now. It's like a tight, like 100 or 105 minutes, so it's a good night
Love
of theater.
That.
Love that.
No intermission.
Exactly.
Just the dream.
And it's the current cast is 9 out men, like, and many of them quite famous men. And it's kind of like, it's produced by Ryan Murphy. It's directed by Joe Mantello. It's got this great pedigree behind it. And it's Zach and it's Jim Parsons and it's Matt Bomer, friend of the show, Matt Bomer. Mm-hmm. A great
Andrew
cast. Andrew Rannell steals everything.
It's amazing.
Every moment.
Are you going to tell everyone the special secret?
What's the special
about
secret?
The show, if you have the right seat?
Oh, right.
Just a little, it's a little tip. Tip to my friends out there, if you go see the show and you're sitting along one of the sides, Matt Bomer is a shower scene, and if you look in the ceiling, there's a mirror, and you can see a little of the top of his butt. And I warned Josh about it, but I don't think he remembered to look.
No, I remembered. I wasn't in those optimal seats.
Mm, that sucks.
Yeah, well, I've seen Magic Mike
and
Magic Mike
XXL. Was like, Oh, yeah.
I've seen enough. I mean, it's a wonderful body to behold.
It's a great top of the butt. Great top. One of the best I've ever seen.
You're making things awkward because...
I'm just trying to get people to buy tickets.
No, it's all good. It's all good. It's just I've had this experience twice now in recent shows where I've happened to know one of the actors and I see the show and they're naked on stage and then I see them afterwards in the show and there's just like...
Are you talking Lee Pace's Full Frontal and Angels?
Yes.
That's a little more intimidating than the top of the butt.
Right. That's true. Yes.
You could sketch Lee Pace after.
I know every inch of Lee Pace. And Lee, if you're listening, I so apologize. You have nothing to apologize
but congratulations.
For. Congratulations. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, what were we talking about? Oh, Matt's
Zach.
Butt. Yeah, Matt's butt, Zach. Wonderful in the show. The show runs through August. Get tickets if you can, Boys in the Band. We certainly talk a bunch about the show. We talk about a lot of things, though.
I know what you were excited to talk about.
Heroes?
Well, I would love to save the cheerleader, save the world. I was a huge Heroes fan.
I forgot that Kristen Bell was on Heroes.
She was?
Yeah.
Who was she?
I don't know. I looked at when I was like doing my research. It was like unless I misread.
Was it like Gossip Girl? She did like the VOs at the beginning.
We sound like such posers now, but I think she was. I don't remember Heroes too well.
I remember horn rimmed glasses. It was
right. I confess, like I was one of those like many I think that like watched
the first season.
Mm-hmm. And we talk about it. He does talk about sort of because Heroes was his big break, and that was a show that just like burned so quickly, and then it kind of burned out.
Yeah.
Partially, he talks about because of the writer's strike, I think. But man, it worked out so well for him. During that writer's strike, he landed his first film, which was Star Trek.
I was going to, what, you were, tell me all about Spock.
I played it cool, but yes.
You did?
We talked a ton about Spock.
You didn't play it cool. It's what I'm curious about.
No. He knows what I am.
So you can't hide it.
No, I mean, it was cool because, like, that reboot of that franchise did occur around 10 years ago, around, like, when I started at MTV. So I've definitely, like, been through, that's another one of those casts that I've been through the saga with. So it's, it was kind of a good full circle moment to talk to him about both the Star Trek films, the importance of theater in his life. And he's also really frank and really, I don't know. He's just like a positive force for good in that, you know, talks about his decision to come out when he did, which was after he did Angels in America off Broadway and after he was deeply affected by a rash of teen suicides. So, I mean, he's just like an important voice to hear about, especially in these times. And by the end, I feel like we go to a dark place in terms of like all the horrible stuff going on in the world right now. But hopefully we wrap it up in a nice bow and give you some hope on the way out.
Hopefully. He's a smart and really, really talented dude.
Definitely.
I'm a fan, Zach.
There you go. So enjoy this conversation with Zachary Quinto. What else to talk about? Oh, you saw one of a friend of the podcast last night. I sadly missed it.
Last night I saw Middleditch and Schwartz on, they did Broadway.
They are selling out across the country.
Yeah, two-man long-form improv got a standing ovation on Broadway. So
we're so happy.
If they're coming to your town, go see Middleditch and Schwartz. It's amazing.
They're the best at what they do.
It's crazy. Yeah. How fast their minds work. You're like, these two idiots are pretty smart.
You can say that about Ben, but Middleditch is pretty smart.
I guess. I'm like, wow, the way that they tied back into jumping into the other one's asshole at the end is really brilliant. It's just like the most lowbrow but weirdly brilliant stuff.
I love it.
Yeah, wow. You would. You would. I highly recommend.
Wonderful. Happy to hear that that is selling out. And yes, if you have the opportunity, go seek them out. You were just saying they're going to be at Comic-Con. Maybe I'll see them there. Who knows?
Your Super Bowl.
It's pretty much, yeah. Lots of Comic-Con talk to come. I will be there. Sadly, Sammy won't.
My mom decides to change her birthday.
It's so inconsiderate of mom.
I agree. She knows it's my favorite weekend of the year, too.
But there's lots of exciting things to come.
There are.
It's not over.
It's not over.
It's just still getting started.
Yeah.
But that's for another podcast to talk about.
We'll get there.
Okay. In the meantime, please review, rate, and subscribe.
Please.
Spread the good word of Happy Sad Confused and enjoy this conversation with Zachary
Quinto.
Zach Quinto. It sounds Australian the way you just said it.
Zach Quinto.
That doesn't sound Australian.
That was him. He's here.
God. Enjoy the conversation. Why, look, it's Zachary Quinto in my office.
How's it going?
It's good to see you, man.
It's good to see you, too.
Yeah, this is a different kind of environment than we usually do.
I know.
Usually a crazy carpet or a junket or something silly, but look.
I like this.
You're in my weird world.
I get to really take in your, how you interact with the world around you. Well, how long have you been in this office?
A few years. Uh-huh. The one at our other Midtown MTV office was very similar, but thankfully I'm at a better part of town now.
Uh-huh, for sure.
I don't miss the Times Square.
For sure.
Hullabaloo. But yeah, I always say this is kind of like the bedroom I wanted as like a 12-year-old.
Great.
Right?
I could see that.
The movie posters I worshipped got action figures and silliness.
It's awesome.
And a list of cool New Yorkers, of which you are one.
I am up there.
How long have you made your life here in New York, Zachary?
I came back here 5 years ago when I was doing the Glass Menagerie. Mm-hmm. And I decided I had been in L.A. long enough, and I wanted to just have the experience of living in New York, which I, you know, had always fantasized about.
Yeah. I would expect also you started to get to a point in your career where you didn't need to be in L.A., right? There were enough opportunities, and certainly I know theater is an important part of your life, mm-hmm. that, like, you weren't missing out.
I did feel that way. Right? I did feel like, yes, I had gotten myself to a place where I could generate or at least, field the opportunities that were coming to me remote, not in the epicenter of things. Although, that said, I do feel like I love LA. I'm a person who really enjoys and appreciates the city, and I miss it. I miss it actually. So I'm now that I've come to New York and really established myself here and like created a home for myself here, I'm gonna now explore the options of LA as well again, which I'm looking forward to. Yeah, for sure.
I've explored your apartment via video apparatus. Don't worry, I wasn't home invading.
That's all right. I mean, it wouldn't be all right if you were home invading, but I get it. I know.
I thought we were at the point where I could just like barge in whenever I want.
Probably.
you have a lovely apartment, thanks. You and Miles. Yeah. Do you just put up with the crystals that he loves, or do you actually believe in the crystals?
No, I've come to appreciate them, and he's converted me to crystal aficionado of my own sort of, my own. But
for context, there's an Architectural Digest like tour that you guys did of the of your lovely place, and
they did a crystal counter in the video because Miles has a lot of them around. I think they counted like 55, and that wasn't even probably
the secret crystal room. They didn't even get.
Yeah, they didn't even get to the stash of ones that we hid for the photo shoot. But there is a lot of crystal energy in the apartment, which I think is actually valuable.
Has he been with you through like a production? Like, has he seen you on like through a? Was he with you like with Glass Menagerie? Just the first time he's seen. Okay,
we've been together for 5 years. Okay. So we met right before I did the Glass Menagerie on Broadway.
I guess I'm just curious. Like, is it a different Zachary during a production? Because it's a different. You know, it's a day. It's a tough, not a tough job, but it's a day job. It's a routinized
actually,
day job.
The interesting thing is it's a night job. Right, and I think one of the differences is like it's nocturnal Zachary.
Right.
I've been saying to him for the past couple of weeks, I was like, I got to get back on a better sleep schedule because the Tonys were the 11th of June, I guess.
Right.
And the Tony, you know, that's a notoriously late night. You know, I think we were out and up until almost the sun, and
you have a show the next day or not?
We did have a show the next night, but it just really screwed up my circadian rhythms and and the show in general. I mean, we're not doing a long play. Our play is relatively short, you know, by comparison, but it's just the energy, you know, getting kind of worked up that late at night, and it takes me a while to decompress. So I've been up a lot later, like on average, I'd say I've been up to like 2:30 or 3 in the morning for the last few weeks, and I don't love it.
So,
I don't love it.
Are you generally a creature of habit? I mean, you must enjoy in some ways this is as routinized as you can get as an actor.
Yes, I am. Am I a creature of habit? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I kind of roll with whatever is in front of me. You know, if I have 5 a.m. calls, like I actually do tomorrow, then I roll with that. But if I'm working at night, I'm definitely a night owl more than a morning person. So doing a play suits me. But I do like not having to struggle to get my day started because I'm tired, you know. So that's a bit, I'm trying to find the balance of that right now.
So what, you're shooting something while
I'm doing a couple of episodes of Kimmy Schmidt right now. So I'm shooting. It is a good cause.
Insane cause.
Totally. So I have been working on that. It's just like, you know, 5 days or something like that. But it's been really fun.
Yeah.
Getting to work with Jane Krakowski, who I adore and who's so talented and funny.
Totally.
So that's been fun. Yeah.
I confess, I have to catch up. I only got. Mm-hmm. I love the first season, but it's like, you know how it is nowadays.
Of course,
it's an embarrassment
of
riches.
Oh my God.
It's funny. You mentioned Glass Menagerie, which I got a chance to see you and Cherry. And I remember seeing that show, and it was fantastic. And I had like seats very close, and I was. There was an older couple sitting next to my wife and I, and it must have been like the worst nightmare for an actor because. Not for you, thankfully, but an older gentleman, right as soon as like Cherry came out, screamed out at the top of his lungs, "Is that Cherry Jones?" Just like breaking the silence. Is that like for you? Is there still in the pit of your stomach the worry that like someone's gonna scream out, "I love you, Spock!" Like at some point?
No, I don't. No, I don't feel that. I don't feel that.
No. Not planted in your brain. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You know, I think the funniest one I've had on this play actually is, I don't know how much your listeners know about the play, but it's a play about 9 gay men. It was a revolutionary play in its time, which was premiered in 1968. And And it's had a lot, you know, it resonates profoundly one way or another, especially in the LGBTQ community. And for some of the older guys who were around when the play came out, this production has been really, I know there've been a lot of them coming to the show, basically. And we were doing and I play this very acerbic kind of character. His name is Harold. And at one point in the play, you know, part of the structure of the play is that it's very funny and then it gets very serious, like very dark. And my character tends to break the tension with sort of one-liners and little interjections here and there that really kind of have they lighten the mood.
Diffusion, right?
And so in one of these moments toward the end of the play, when it's really heavy, I have one line where I interject something and then like the audience laughs. And then this man in the audience just went, Oh, Harold twice. Like actually
classic Harold.
And I almost broke because it was so like, wait, what? Like you're not watching in a movie, you know, like it was pretty funny, but you know, it's part of the
joy.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. You have kind of like the ideal role in some ways that an actor wants, because you are the guy that everybody talks about the first half of the show.
Right, for 30 minutes.
Right. And then you get to come in with a flourish. Mm-hmm. And I mean, everybody gets like
everybody gets their own little entrance for the most part.
And,
right.
And some acerbic great one-liners, but you in particular, it seems like you get the lion's share perhaps.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you kind of alluded to some of the intriguing aspects of this show. I think 9 principal characters, right?
9 actors.
9 actors. So Ryan Murphy produced it.
Right.
He's producing it. All out actors. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many fascinating aspects of this. You go a ways back with some of the actors, I know.
Yeah, well, I went to college with Matt Bomer, who's in the play. We've known each other for 25 years. Crazy to say that. And I've been friends with Andrew Rannells and Jim Parsons for the better part of 10 years. And then I've done a movie with Charlie Carver, who's in the play, and a play with Brian Hutchison, who's in the play.
Right.
So of the 8 other guys in the show, there are only 3 of them that I hadn't met before this.
Right.
And now they're, you know, brothers in arms as well. So there is a lot of interconnectivity, and other people in the play have other paths of, so there was a real sense of, bond coming into this and connection and yes, and you know, it's the 50th anniversary of this play. It's never been done on Broadway. It's a powerful piece, and it's shocking to me how resonant it still is 50 years later. How funny, but how resonant, and how the themes I think are really still there.
You know,
they still
it's intriguing because well, one thing I want to mention, you mentioned you go back with Matt all the way to Carnegie Mellon, I believe. I'm seeing Mr. Joe Manganiello later this week, actually.
Oh, cool.
A fellow Carnegie Mellon friend, I believe.
Yeah, Joe grew up about a mile away from me.
Is that right?
Yeah, we knew each other from even before Carnegie
Mellon.
That's
so funny. So what? It must be inconceivable to think about like you knowing Matt back then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if either of you were out back then or what, but like just even the notion that 25 years later you would be out in a Broadway play like this, collaborating on this level.
Yeah.
There's like 3 different levels of just surrealness to that equation.
Well, one of the great joys about getting older and being as fortunate as I've been in my work is getting to share that with people who have known.
Yeah.
You know, whether I know them from college or just from early days of making a go at it. There's something, you know, Jesse Tyler Ferguson is a really good friend of mine. There's just something really special about watching your friends create their own path, forge their own path, and succeed.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really special. And it's really, you know, with Matt, it's his Broadway debut to come back to. You know, to come back to the same theater where I did The Glass Menagerie, which is another layer of specialness to this experience for me. And I, you know, as soon as I found out we were back in the booth, I called my agent and was like, I want my same dressing room. and so once I worked that out, I called Matt and said, hey, I'm going to be in number 4. I hope you'll do number 5 so we can be neighbors. And that's the way it worked out.
What do you remember of back in the Carnegie Mellon days? Like, were you Did you take the work very seriously
so
then?
Were
you
really? Seriously. Yeah. Oh my God.
this is Mellow Zach right now. This is
I was like, ugh.
A little insufferable back then, if I met you?
I don't know if I was insufferable, but I was sufferable. You know what I mean? Like, I was definitely like, yeah, I took it very seriously. I really did. And I'm glad I did. You know, I loved college. I just, you know, I soaked it all up. I was just very eager. Mm-hmm. I was very, you know, I really wanted, I think, you know, as I got into therapy and started to kind of unravel my underlying, engine, right? Like, yep. As I lifted up the hood, let's lean into the car metaphor.
Sure.
As I got under the hood and I started to kind of, look at the parts that drove me, I think I really would say that I was hungry for validation in college in a way that, you know, made me want to be the best, right? Because I wanted people to tell me I was good. And I needed that, I think, in a lot of ways from teachers and from people who I respected. Sure. And looked up to. And so I was really ambitious and, you know, I really cared a lot about doing well and being considered talented and really, you know, that drove me. And I think
that's a common story for a lot of actors,
sure,
I found.
Sure.
Or for any profession. I mean, that's, I think, how a lot of people find their careers is finding like some kind of early validation.
Yes, and I'm not judging myself for that.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely feel like it's part of what got me to where I am. I wouldn't necessarily even change aspects of myself back then, but there are aspects of myself I probably would change, mm-hmm. you know, and just to know like sooner how to provide those feelings to myself rather than looking for them outside of myself.
Right.
But I think it is a very common story, not only for actors, but for human beings. And I think it's something that people spend lifetimes exploring or not. And I did take it very seriously.
Was it a rude awakening coming out of school? Did you feel like you were like ready to take on the world?
I was ready to take on the world. Yeah, for sure. When I came out of school, anything was possible in my mind. And I was, you know, that ambition carried over into the real world for me. I was super focused and like myopically so in a way just on my career. The flip side of that or the downside of that was that I kind of tied my self-worth into, you know, the accomplishments that I was able to achieve or not, you know, and that took a lot of softening as well. I was really, you know, I was like, let's do this, you know?
And what was the path in your mind? Was it, cause like, if you look at the early resume, it's a lot of episodic.
Sure.
Television.
I had a very, very conventional experience coming into the business, you know,
get the CSI out of the way, get all that.
Yep. Do it. Check. CSI. Check. Touched by an Angel. Check.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I,
Lizzie McGuire. Check.
Yeah. Lizzie McGuire, please. But the way it was in my mind actually was that I would come to New York. I never imagined that I would be in LA. So that was a huge and an immediate curveball was that in LA I was welcomed with the opportunities to do to have a manager and an agent, right? So audition right away. And I think in New York it was for whatever reason going to be a little bit more. So idea that I would come here and work my way up off Broadway, and that was how I thought I would do it. Just got flipped on its ear, and I
was because you were getting some work in LA.
I was getting more opportunities presented to me, so I went to LA right away.
It's interesting because, like, again, looking at at your career, like, I didn't realize at the time, like, was Star Trek the first film?
Yeah, that was my first movie.
That's crazy to me. So, like, you must have been going up for films, like, or was
I didn't really go up for films as much as I did TV. I really, you know, TV was sort of my milieu of you know, like, that's just the way it worked for me. I didn't really have.
Were you concerned at the time that, like, because, you know, again, knowing how seriously you did and do take the work, like, mm-hmm. The ultimate ambition wasn't to be on Heroes eventually. You know, I mean, that was probably a nice, great, exciting opportunity, but it wasn't like I've made it. That was probably like, this will get me to a place that's more creatively satisfying, or maybe I'm making assumptions.
Well, I mean, what was my ultimate ambition at the time, I guess, was just to get to work, to be recognized for my work and to work consistently. And it just, like, the way it played out for me, because of the people that I chose to work with, you know, they were mid-level agents and managers, right. And they had more relationships and more access in the world of television. So that's where my path took me. You know, and so my goals and ambitions, I would say originally, were kind of calibrated to the opportunities that were being presented to me. So at first I was, you know, going up for co-stars, and then I got a couple of those, and then, you know, guest stars. And then it was like, oh, well, I want the lead, you know, the guest lead on an episode of something. And then I want a recurring role in something. And
got it.
So the time Heroes came along, I had been systematically kind of building this career for myself doing television. And I would say something like Heroes, which was a phenomenon when it came out. You know, at that time, I felt like, okay, I have achieved what I had been, these goals that I had been setting for myself. Right. Creatively, it became clear that, you know, after the first season happened, and it was this kind of global phenomenon, and then the second season started, and then the writer's strike happened, and that really changed everything on that show. It was, I think Heroes was one of the big casualties of the writers. I mean, a lot of shows suffered from it, but because it, like, interrupted our second season, the upside of the writer's strike that it allowed me to go film Star Trek during the writer's strike, because Star Trek, the script had already been written. So we were allowed to make that movie during the writer's strike. And so I didn't have to miss any episodes of Heroes, which we were in the middle of negotiating how that would work. But by the time we went back to Heroes, it just never regained.
It felt like it was always playing catch up to initial.
And they hadn't really plotted it out far enough ahead to, like, keep it. And, you know, my character was never meant to stay around as long as he did.
Right.
And so, yes, I mean, it became clear to me that year when I was doing Heroes and Star Trek that my ambitions were already outpacing the level that I had achieved, and I needed to do something to kind of keep up with them. And so that's when I started my production company.
And I want to get to that, because it seems like you ramped up, especially after Star Trek on the producing front. So let's cover a little bit of Trek first, and then I want to get into that. So, like, as I recall, I mean, I started my MTV career right around when the whole Star Trek Kelvin universe started, and it was so exciting for me as, like,
Trekkie. Totally.
I remember you guys coming out at Comic-Con, the whole thing. I mean, the casting process must have been insane for you. I mean, I remember, like, rumors of, like, Adrian Brody going up, like, big name actors were going in. Mm-hmm. Were you aware of, like, the competition? Did you feel like you had as good a shot as anybody?
I mean, my experience of that was so singular. I there was something to me where it wasn't even a question. I don't know how to explain it, because I didn't have any reason to be so sure of it. And I also wasn't even a Star Trek fan, you know? But somebody had told me that they were making the movie, that JJ was directing it, and that I should go up for Spock. And it was like the minute I read that in an email that someone sent me, it was like it was already done. And I started talking about it in interviews that I was doing for Heroes. And I talked about it enough that by the time they started casting the movie, April Webster, the casting director, had caught wind of me talking about it, and reached out, and I had, like, you know, got a meeting with her. And I'll never forget how it played out. I went in on a Sunday. It was April 15th. And I went in. I went in like a couple of a day or two before, because they wouldn't let me have the script. So you're like, well, he has to come in and, like, read the sides, etc. I don't even think I read the whole script, but they just gave me my sides. And so I took a notebook and I wrote my scene in the notebook so that I could take it with me and work on it at home. But it was only like a 3-page scene. It wasn't a lot. And then I went in on Sunday. And April's amazing. She's a fantastic casting director and just a great person. And so she was, you know, she and I worked on it and read it together and then put it on tape. And that was it. And then I was leaving the next day on Monday to go on a trip. And I was going to Paris for Heroes with, like, Tim Kring and Jeff Loeb to do, like, a press event in Paris. And then I had built another month of travel. So I left, like, April 16th. I was in Paris for a week, and then I went traveling for a month in Europe by myself during May. And I came back a week before my 30th birthday, and I didn't really think about, I just did the thing with April and then left. Got back to New York right before my 30th birthday, and while I was in New York, got a call that JJ wanted to meet me. I flew back to LA for my 30th birthday party. I met with JJ the next day, and then the next day after that, I got the job. So it was super, like, it doesn't happen that way. You know what I mean? And it was just so, I don't know, it's just... That might have been a really boring story. You're gonna have to.
No, it wasn't.
That,
no, no. It was good. I mean, so I'm curious. Were you? Was that you alone, or were you reading with other actors? Were you reading with Chris and other potential Kirks?
No, I ended up reading. I was the first person. I was, to my knowledge, I was the first person that they saw for Spock, and I was the first person that they cast. So that was in June of May and June of 2007. And they didn't cast Chris until like October, I think.
Right
before we started shooting, because Chris went in and read for it, and they didn't hire him. And then they went and auditioned a bunch of other people, and then he came back in, and then I read with him, and I read with Chris and two other people, I think.
I bet I'm guessing Mike Vogel, because I remember he was.
Right.
I remember he was the other one everyone was talking about. Was
yeah,
like the
yeah, and contender. Also Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah, I heard about that too.
And I read with those guys, and I knew Chris because we had a lot of mutual friends, and we had known each other, and so I was really gunning for Chris just because I really
had an association.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, there's so many things that we could talk about there. I want to talk about the Leonard Nimoy relationship, which is obviously something that has been so important in your life and must have been totally unexpected. This kind of mentorship, friendship does not happen often. It could have just been he had no dog in the race to embrace you the way he did. I'm just curious, what was the first point of connection between you and Leonard? I mean,
we met in an elevator at Comic-Con that day when they announced that I'd be taking over the role, and it was packed full of people, and we got in, and they shepherded him in first, and then I got into the elevator, and all the publicists from Paramount and da-da-da-da, and all these people, and they introduced us in the elevator as we were going up to Hall H, and I remember he was like, oh, yeah, whatever. And then just before the doors opened, he just turned to me and he said, you have no idea what you're in for. And he walked out of the elevator. And I was like, well, there it is. Thanks so much. But that really did kick off. And then he and his wife, Susan, with whom I'm still incredibly close, invited me to their house for a barbecue that they were having. And at that barbecue, Leonard and I set up a day for me to come over. And we had lunch, just the two of us, at his house. And that was really the beginning, of this incredible friendship. And there's something really... My dad died when I was 7. And he and Leonard were just about the same age. And there was something very profound for me personally at that time. I just turned 30. I was kind of at this milestone and crossroads of sorts in my own life. And to have this paternal figure come into my life in such a powerful way was incredibly stabilizing and really grounding for me. And I think that our friendship was built on that.
Right.
And Leonard was never one for over sentimentalization. He was a very, he was just so incredible. I mean, he really was so wise and,
Well, if you look just like at the way he lived his life post-Trek and was able to kind of like reinvent himself in so many different ways and explore whether it was photography or directing.
Poetry, directing, art collection. I mean, he really did it all.
And especially in a time when nowadays, you do an iconic role on TV or in film, there's a much more openness, it seems, to like letting somebody explore different parts of their lives. In the 60s, it was, TV stars did not become film stars and were not welcomed with open arms to other aspects. I mean, was that, he wrote the book, literally, I Am Not Spock, and then he wrote the book, I Am Spock. So he like went through that journey.
Yeah.
Was that something that he talked to you about in terms of like how to deal with what he knew was going to be a, something that would hang over you?
We talked a little bit about it, but I don't really feel like, I wasn't up against the same kind of restrictions that he was. Yeah, I think it was a little bit different. And I learned from his relationship to the character. And but I don't know. I didn't really feel like that was I was on the same path in that regard. Mm-hmm. You know. But we talked about it. I mean, we really covered all our bases in the you know, we were friends from. For about the last 10 years of his life. Yeah.
You, so after Trek, it seems like you, I'm trying to get my chronology right, but yeah. Did you go right into Angels off Broadway, Angels in America?
What did I do? No. Wait, did I? Yeah, kind of. Well, I did, yeah, Trek, and then I did More Heroes.
Right.
And then, so Heroes finished, and then I did Margin Call.
Right.
And then I did Angels.
So even when you were doing Angels, you came out after that.
I did. I didn't even. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Which is interesting to me. I mean, I know I've heard you talk a little bit about sort of the connection between you did an It Gets Better video.
Right.
But you know, it occurs to me like, you know, I saw the new production of Angels, which is remarkable.
Mm.
And, you know, and Lee Pace went through this kind of journey himself, having done Angels and decided this was the time to talk about his sexuality. But did you feel like at the time when you were doing Angels that that was something hanging over you? Or,
yes.
Or even in the wake of doing Trek, like, were there converse? Did Paramount give a shit? Did, like...
Did Paramount give a shit? I don't know. I mean, I feel like the institutional homophobia, which still exists in our industry, was, you know, percolating for me in the studio system. I don't think it was ever overt... or
it wasn't like the meeting, how are we going to handle
this? Yes, exactly.
This
no. I think it was sort of, it's more insidious now.
Right.
Even then it was more insidious, but it still exists. It still exists today. There's no denying that. And I, you know, but I didn't feel hindered by my own personal journey or my own identity, my authentic identity. I just didn't feel particularly ready to discuss it in a public forum.
Right.
And when I did Angels in America, there was for me an onus that I felt to at least acknowledge it for myself. I mean, I was already out in my life. It wasn't like
sure.
I was hiding or denying myself. I just, I remember pulling Tony Kushner and Michael Greif, the director, aside and saying, hey, you know, I just want you to be aware that I feel like this may be a part of my experience in one way or another coming out publicly, and I don't want it to distract from our collaboration or our, you know, our
right.
our effort to make this the best production of this play that it can be. I want that to be the story. And ultimately, I didn't find the footing to do it during that production. It wasn't until a year later when I was doing the press tour for Margin Call
right.
that I actually made the decision to come out. And it was very organic for me. It just wasn't the time when I did Angels. I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
That's when I made the It Gets Better video, when I was doing Angels in America. So I was ready to offer my support and you know, a sense of compassion to people who were going through the struggles that a lot of those... There was a real rash of teen suicides that summer, but it wasn't until the next year that Jamie Rademeyer, who is a young man who made an It Gets Better video himself, and then months later took his own life, that I really in an instant woke up and said, I can't do this. I can't be the successful, accomplished, working actor who's achieving all these things that I set out to achieve for myself and deny my true identity.
Yeah.
I just can't do that. I'm not capable of that. And no lead in a studio film franchise or, you know, all the money in the world isn't worth that level of disparity that I need to carry around with me, that fractured sense of self. I am incapable of that level of dishonesty for myself. And when I look at the world around me and see that kids are killing themselves because they're not able to get there themselves at such a young age, when I've had now 15 years more than them or 20 years more than them to reconcile those two parts of myself, I just can't do that. I need to do something to stop kids from being bullied to death.
Were you bullied as a kid?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, who's not, right?
Yeah.
I was.
But
I will say, you know, for me, and I don't know to what I can attribute this, but in the face of bullying, I was made stronger in the face of bullying. The way that I dealt with bullying was, you know, sure, I was made afraid of it to a certain extent. Like, oh God, I don't want to be picked on, or I don't want to be pushed into the lockers, or I don't want to be called a faggot. But it planted this root for me of like, actually, even though I don't know this yet, or even though I can't, let me say, even though I can't articulate this yet, I know this on some level, that the part of me that makes me different makes me special. And I am special in a way that none of you people that are sitting here calling me names or pushing me around are ever going to understand. And I'm going to just go over here and incubate that and find the people in my life who will amplify it and support it and nurture it. And I was very lucky. I was very lucky to be surrounded by family, friends, and teachers who did just that. And so that was the thing for me, was like, to be able to empower kids to know that it is the thing that you hate the most about yourself that can often become the most powerful amplifier of who you really are and what you have to offer the world. And that was really, I was really lucky. I don't know where that came from, but I'm grateful that it found its way into my life. That
you mentioned, so you the first film I believe you produced is Margin Call.
Yeah.
So is that, you know, you've got Kevin Spacey in that film. Does that color that experience at all? I mean, what was, you know, Kevin was obviously, I mean, no one's going to quarrel with his talent. He's an amazing actor.
He's a brilliant actor.
And everybody in the industry knew he was gay. That wasn't the issue. I mean, for some, they resented that he wasn't using his platform. That's a whole nother discussion. Mm-hmm. But the circumstances in which he did come out were certainly less than ideal. I mean, and you took him to task, as many did. I mean, he seemed to exploit a situation and tried to kind of deflect in a bizarre way.
Right.
What was your, I was curious, like, what was your interaction with him prior to all this horribleness?
Well, here's what I can say.
Yeah.
I there is no part of me that wishes him ill. I respect his talent profoundly. And the opportunity to work with him was incredible, really, you know. Kevin is of a different generation, and I think he really, his relationship to his own sexuality was entirely influenced by that generation of thinking. And also, you know, a lot changed in our industry very quickly, and rightfully so. I mean, it took too long for it to change, but it changed very quickly once the domino of Harvey Weinstein kind of fell.
Yeah.
And so I think what was acceptable 10 years ago became immediately, not that what Kevin did was ever acceptable, the mentality of our industry, there was a much higher level of tolerance of bad behavior. And so, I don't know. I mean, I feel like there was, to boil down your question, that experience was a great joy for me.
Right.
And what I learned about him later doesn't diminish the joy that I had in that experience, of which he was one part. There were, you know, the putting the movie together, producing the movie,
yeah.
Stanley Tucci, Paul Bettany, Jeremy Irons,
watching
Demi Moore,
JC's, yeah.
You know, debut, all of those things. Yeah. Like, Kevin was one part of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like there are consequences for illegal and inappropriate behavior, and I feel like we're seeing that now, that power, that just because you're powerful and just because you're a powerful white man, gay or straight, you're not, you know, you are culpable. And yeah. I think that's absolutely as it should be.
No, I mean, it's been brought up on this podcast a lot, as you can imagine, not to mention, like, my own career started working for Charlie Rose, my first 4 years.
Wow.
I don't know if
wow.
you knew that. Yeah, so, I mean, it's fascinating.
And it is,
times.
You know, and I said this when it happened. It's shameful that's how he chose. I mean, it's just sad, you know, and because he's infinitely more, you know, accomplished than I am, and older and been at it longer, and
right.
and if only there, but you can't. You know, people are wounded. People are wounded, and their childhoods are horrific. And you know, you can't, like, there are
right.
extenuating circumstances, and I think it, you know, it manifested in a particularly dark way with him. And yeah. It's unfortunate that we're now deprived of what he could offer creatively to the world because of behavior that he chose to engage in.
Truly.
But that's nobody's fault but his own.
On the positive note, yes. You launched the producing career, which yes. has been flourishing ever since, yeah. and you're very active. You have a new TV show coming
yes,
soon.
Starting next month, yeah.
In Search of.
Also in you know, the spirit, the reign tradition of Leonard Nimoy.
Exactly. I remember as a kid watching Lights, Camera, Action. Uh-huh. Has anybody offered you that TV show yet?
No. I think I'm good now. I've covered my bases.
This seems like a no-brainer, though, because yeah. this lets you travel the world.
Yeah. Sure.
And
we went all over the place.
And answer questions or try to answer questions that maybe you have or that are fascinating to explore. Mm-hmm. Where did you go? What's the coolest place you got to visit?
I think Morocco is the coolest place I got to go. I've never been there before and I loved it. But we were all over the place. We were in Melbourne, Australia. We were in Liverpool. We were in Sardinia. We were in Greece. We were in Morocco, and then all over the United States as well. So there was a lot of travel at the beginning of this year. We did 10 episodes, starts airing July 20th on History.
Do you find Bigfoot?
No, we're not looking for Bigfoot.
Okay, so that's season two.
That's season two, right. Okay. That, I mean, you know, the original show, like when we set it up at the History Channel, they really wanted to kind of keep the integrity or the spirit of the original show. But my thing was like, we got to move the dial. You know, we've come a long way in the last 40 years. Let's look at where, you know, we are now. And let's look at some of the blue chip episodes like Aliens. We do Monsters of the Deep. But then we do things that I'm more interested in, like artificial intelligence, life after death, mind control. We do an episode on sinkholes. We do a two-part episode on the Lost City of Atlantis, time travel. I'm missing one or two, but those are sort of the themes amazing. Of the first season, yeah.
So, and the producing is spanning all sorts of different forms. Because I also noticed that early on you were producing a ton of shorts. Like,
was about, you know, we set up our production company, and a lot of things have changed since, you know, I'm actually now moving my company in a new direction and not working with the guys that I started my company with anymore. So things are really transforming in great ways and growing and expanding. But originally we all went to college together and we decided to start this company. I decided to start the company and then found my friends who are in other areas of the business. And it sort of made sense for us to all come together to do Before the Door Pictures is the name of the company. But we had never done it before. You know, none of us, one of us was a producer of sorts, but kind of an assistant to a producer. So we cut our teeth on a lot of like short form content and that was early on. And then aligned ourselves with some friends who are making work in New York, film kind of improv-y group. And so we executive produced some of that stuff. And that was really just to learn how to do it.
Yeah.
And Margin Call was our first feature and our first project that we all kind of came together to make.
So what's the priority now?
Kind of striking out on my own now and doing my own stuff. And so for me, it's about, I'm developing a lot of different stuff in different mediums. So I have a bunch of film stuff, but I have a bunch of TV stuff. And I also am kind of really open to projects that could live either place, because I think, you know, anymore, the landscape of certainly television and accessibility and how people digest their content, and it's changed so drastically in the last 5 years that, you know, I feel like any story can be broken open or stretched out or slowed down or explored in different ways depending on what the medium is. So I've been trying to look for content that can lend itself to many different perspectives and many different modes of storytelling. And
it's interesting, isn't it? Like how we kind of have to like let go of some of the things that we, like the forms we grew up with. I know like on my side of the microphone, it's like, you know, the dream growing up was like, you know, you host like an hour long late night talk show. Like that's the form. And it still exists, but like you can break it down into its components now. And what I realize is like, I've been doing that in a way for 10 years. Like I've been doing sketches. I've been doing interviews. I've been hosting things like, I just do it. It's just consumed in different forms.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Don't chase something that doesn't matter to kids today anyway.
Yeah, be organic and be malleable, because that's the way the business has unfolded in the last 5 years for sure, but, you know, 10 years, definitely. Yeah. So I do think, yeah, that, you know, I'm always interested in complex characters, relationships. We're doing some really cool stuff and developing some really interesting ideas right now.
Well, there's the Tab Hunter project, right?
That's right. One, yeah. Yeah. Tab and Tony. I was approached. Tab Hunter, for people who don't know, is a very, very famous actor from the 50s. He was kind of one of the most bankable matinee idol box office movie stars of the 50s, of the golden era of Hollywood. And he is gay. He's still alive. He's an amazing guy. At the height of his career, he was in a 5-year relationship with Anthony Perkins. At the height of Anthony Perkins, they were both sort of these huge actors. So Tab wrote a book called Tab Hunter Confidential, which they then made into a documentary. And then I was contacted by Tab and his partner, Alan Glasser, and their producing partner, Neil Konigsberg, about the desire to tell the Tab and Tony story. And I was immediately interested and had a call with them and met them for lunch in L.A. at Musso and Frank. It was like super Perfect. Old Hollywood. and decided to come on board and to develop that with them. And so I called JJ, actually, because I thought, you know, his perspective on this could be really unique and interesting. And JJ was really interested. And so set it up with Bad Robot, and then we sold it to Paramount. So we're in development on that. And Doug Wright, who's an incredible playwright and screenwriter, is writing the script on that for us. So we're in the middle of that.
Would you act in that, or is that...
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I can't... I think 10, 15 years ago, I could have played Anthony Perkins at this time in his life, but the relationship happened when they were in their mid to late 20s, and though I look good for 41, I don't look that good. You know, I feel like it's a little bit of a stretch for me to play that young. So I don't know, but there are other roles, and the script isn't yet written, so... We'll see. I'm really so excited for what Doug comes up with. And that's one thing. And then just a number of other, you know, I'm adapting a book into a film or maybe a long-form TV idea. We don't know yet. We'll option an article from Vice that we're developing as well. There's a comic book property that I have in development. Some TV stuff, like podcast stuff. Like I'm just really interested in what the possibilities are out there right now.
And of course, I always have to ask about where we're at on Trek, and it seems like there actually is stuff going on.
There is stuff going on. I mean, I had dinner the other night with SJ Clarkson, who's a great collaborator. SJ is amazing. We worked on Heroes together, and we really hit it off.
And this is the Hemsworth one, right?
Yes.
This is the Hemsworth involved, so maybe it's time travel, who knows, but somehow Hemsworth's getting involved.
Well, I don't know, because I haven't read the script, and I think it's still under construction, as they say. but yes, he is playing all of it.
Is there some, because, you know, even if you just look at the first film, you've already gone through the ringer with this character. You know, his mom's died. Mm-hmm. His planet's been destroyed. Exactly. He saved his best friend in the sequel. Yeah. Is there something that you... you want to explore with a good old Spock at this point? What's left?
Well, Ponfar. We haven't haven't explored the Ponfar.
Right. Is that puberty or menopause? I don't even know what that. I mean, it's somewhere in between.
You know, it's like, I think it's like heat, like going into heat, right? every 7 years or something. I don't know. I mean, you know, we'll see. I do think it's a character that is, it's tricky, you know what I mean? Because there's a very finite range of emotional landscape that can be traversed. And so I don't know yet where we're going to go, but I'm excited to see. And the bottom line is, like, I love the character. I love my fellow actors. Right. And so I'm really looking forward to the opportunity going back and making another one.
Have you gotten the dirt ultimately on this Tarantino one? There's so much confusion out there about whether it is with you guys.
Oh, my assumption is it's with us. I mean, that's how it's been presented. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, look, until, you know, deals are done and contracts are signed and schedules are cleared, I mean, nothing is set in stone. So anything could happen. But my understanding is that Quentin had this idea that they were shaping it and forming it, and he's off to do
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
That's his Manson movie. And then, you know, it would be after that that we would go and maybe do one with him, which is pretty exciting. Yeah, pretty cool.
Okay, coming full circle, finally. Mm-hmm. You've got Boys in the Band going mm-hmm. through August
11th.
Okay, still time to go check this
August
out.
August 11th at the Booth Theater in New York.
Right, it's what, like 105 minutes of delicious theater, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, it's about that.
And you're enjoying this run, you're soaking it all up, because totally. It not only is the character rich, the material's rich, it's an important play, you know, quote unquote important, but it is an important kind of marker of a time, as well as something, as you've said, that's clearly resonating today. So this has got to be something
it's yesterday was Gay Pride, yeah. You know, it's Pride Month. It's really special to be doing this play right now, you know, and to see how far we've come in 50 years, socially, politically, legislatively. But, you know, we're also in the throes of a really tumultuous time. We have an administration in power right now, which is incredibly bigoted and intolerant. And I feel, set against the agenda of the LGBTQ community, among many other minority agendas. And so I think it's a valuable and important time to be holding this mirror up to audiences and yeah. and asking them to recognize this progress so that we don't unravel it, you know, that we don't go backwards.
Well, it does feel like, yeah, up until like a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we felt like, oh, it's all progress. There's no going back totally. At this point. And then it's like,
shocking.
Oh shit, we can.
Shocking how fast and violently things can change.
Yeah. It's a bad dream. We're all yeah. bad nightmare. We're all hoping to wake
this
up from soon.
This past week in particular was really just so unsettling and troubling and sad. And I mean, it's just barbarism. I mean, it's really to me, and you know, I'm not shy about my political point of view, but I do agree that there is this divisiveness that we've all seemed to fallen into. We all seem to have fallen into that. I just don't, you know, it is a disservice to humanity. And I just wish there was some way around it or through it. I mean, I think that the sad part is that the only way around it is through it. And so I think there's going to have to be some real consequences to this kind of divisiveness before we learn again how to appreciate each other, respect each other, love one another. Yeah. You know, that it really can't be, and it is both sides. You know, we've created these portals, right? Our phones and our podcasts and we've created these echo chambers where we can go, cable news, and you know, whether you go and watch InfoWars or you go and watch Last Week Tonight, it's like you're just reinforcing yes. what you already believe, you know, and it's so damaging to the way things used to be, you know, that it's you know, it's unfortunate, it really is. But I feel like, yeah, anyway, I'm on a soapbox. I'm on tangential
okay.
soapbox.
But bring us hope, Zach. I mean, I need hope in my life. Well, 2018 midterms, is that the answer?
Politically, is that the answer? Well, it's our only hope now. I mean, I think that, you know,
I mean, you must feel optimism every night doing this show and sort of seeing the people that come out and seeing.
Sure, but again, it's, you know, it's people who, it's like people who want to see. It's like the diabolical nature of this administration, particularly of Donald Trump, is shocking. And what he is able, because he has zero integrity, and what he's been able to do to destabilize the source of journalism and news, and
he's, you know, muddied the waters.
He's polluted
horribly.
The waters.
It's just, yeah.
That you can't, that he's able to evade in such a like calibrated, calculated, but also not like, I don't know, it's at once he's so diabolical but not thoughtful. So it's like right. It's just recklessness. It's really recklessness. And the damage that's gonna be done is pretty staggering. But I don't know. Look, I feel like yes. Okay, so yes. What can we do? We can change the balance of power in the Congress. You know, we can change the House and the Senate to Democratic control in order that more generous agendas are being served, or at least these restrictive and punitive agendas are being curtailed. And, you know, I don't, well, I mean, yeah, I just, we'll see what happens with this Mueller thing. And right. I mean, God knows, but it's right around the corner, isn't it? We'll be here before we know it.
Well, you know, we've got Pence right behind him. So it's not like that's,
but I mean, I've also talked to people, you know, there are a lot of people who are educated and who are well versed in the political landscape that really feel like he has a chance to win a second term.
Well, you saw the stat the other day that like 90% of Republicans are still.
Yeah, it's shocking to me. It's just shocking to me. What we're presenting to the world right now is some of the darkest, you know, messaging that has ever come out of this country, certainly. And it's so demoralizing. I mean, I just that fucking.
It's okay.
But just that fucking jacket that she wore the other day when she was. I mean, just like, just what that is, what that, like the recklessness of that alone to me was so, I was so despondent that day because it was just like, oh, this is just a game to these people, actually. Yeah. This is just that there's not one person in that world that was thoughtful enough to say, you know what? Even if you, even if that's true, even if it's some kind of a stunt, even if it's a distraction,
you don't mean it the way you mean it, it's going to come across.
But
just
also
so you know.
Just the damage that it does to the morale of your country is worth you giving it a second thought. And it just, nobody there cares. It's just a thoughtless, careless place.
We're coming out the other side, Zach. It's
really,
okay. It's
really
okay.
Ending this on an
No. It's going to be okay. Everybody go check out the Boys in the Band. Look at all these amazing New Yorkers that
New
are.
New Yorkers up there. My neighbor is right there, lives directly across the street from me. I won't tell you who it is because I want to give away.
We're
going to
put addresses afterwards on this all.
Totally. That's the next step, you know?
The old Gawker stalker. We're
really
going to bring it
is.
Back.
Really is.
In all honesty, congratulations on the show. It's
Thanks,
a great piece
man.
Of work. I hope people check it out.
Yeah, come see us.
And check out In Search Of Bigfoot Season 2. But this he's gonna figure out time travel and life
artificial
after death.
Artificial intelligence, life after death.
Very cool.
Mind control.
I didn't even make you order mozzarella sticks in Spock's voice this time.
No, you didn't.
I feel like
we're
it's
really,
a miracle that you've come back to talk to me after that
evolved.
5 years ago or
we've
so.
We've evolved.
Well,
thanks,
maybe
so.
You have. It's good to see
good
you.
Good to see you too. Thanks.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.